The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show, sponsored by Legacy Precious Metals. There's never been a better time to invest in precious metals. Visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We continue our conversation with Dr. Douglas Petrovich. This is so fascinating. It's beyond belief almost. Dr. Petrovich, you were just talking about something. I could see where you're going with it. Reprise the last 20 or 30 seconds so people are brought back up to speed.
Sure. So I was looking at the base of this stela, this 8 to 9 foot tall stone inscription, where there's this picture of a man on a donkey, and that's Kebedet, he who was disfavored. And to our right, to his, in front of the donkey, is his son named Shechem. And then to his, as we're looking at him, to his left is an Egyptian attendant. And what's written above there in mostly Middle Egyptian hieroglyphics is this caption: six Levantines, people from the Levant, six Levantines, Hebrews of Bethel, the beloved. Well, where is Bethel? Well, if you study where the Israelites were in Jacob's lifetime, just before they moved to Egypt, the place where God told him to take his family is Bethel. And it's referred to on this inscription with what's called the Mer glyph. The Mer glyph means beloved, something which is loved by someone or some people. And this is the city that's the city they love. It's like for me, Akron, Ohio is my beloved hometown. It will always be my home city. It's Akron the beloved. And this is what it meant to the Israelites who were speaking about their home city.
But what makes this significant, and I only know this because of my own book, Is Atheism Dead, as I studied, you know, the black obelisk of Shalmaneser and these various things where suddenly somebody sees something, it's been there, but nobody's seen it before. And I'm thinking of, I'm trying to think of the Irish missionary, but he's standing in the British Museum looking at the black obelisk, and suddenly he sees something that no one else has seen, and he realizes, I better tell somebody, because this thing has been sitting here. You know, all these Victorians have been looking at it and they're all excited about it, but I just read something. I just saw something that no one has seen before. This is what happened to you with the stela that you're describing from the 19th century BC. This stela, I don't know when it was discovered, but it was discovered long before you looked at it.
Yeah, and it was published in the 1950s by a phenomenal Egyptologist, probably, at least with Egyptian writings, the foremost authority on hieroglyphics of the 20th century, named Alan Gardner. And he translated the beginning of this caption. He translated the entire text above it, but with this caption, he translated the beginning of it, and he translated it six Syrians. And really, it doesn't – the way that the Egyptian word works, it's the word retinue. It's anybody from the Levant. It doesn't have to be a Syrian. But he translates that, and then he doesn't translate the rest of it, because either he didn't figure it out or because he did figure it out and he knew that, you know, this is a road I don't want to go down and, you know, face
okay,
a gauntlet.
So this is like 70 years ago, 60 years ago, he translates this. And this is what I love. Mm-hmm. Things just get stuck. So he says Syrians, and he doesn't mm-hmm. want to say from the Levant. Hebrew is not in the Levant. I'm mm-hmm. sorry, Egypt is not in the Levant.
Right. And What made it difficult, and maybe this is the reason why Gardner didn't get that next word, Hebrews, correct, because this caption had two anomalies in it. In other words, there were two pictographs, things drawn like a picture, that weren't hieroglyphics, right? And I already knew the 800-plus signs in the Egyptian sign list of hieroglyphics, and I knew they were outliers, that these were not hieroglyphics. So I consulted a Western Semiticist of my dad's generation, and I said to Brian Coveless, and I said, Brian, what is this pictograph and what is this pictograph? And he said, it's easy. This one is a Canaanite syllabic, which means a syllable, and this one is a proto-consonantal letter. It's one of the first alphabetic letters. And I said, that's interesting. What is a Canaanite syllabic and what is a proto-consonantal letter? He literally had to answer me like I was a child. So what I had to do then, Eric, is catch up on 150 years of scholarship, and I did that over a period of months. And once I did that, then I was able to go back to the inscription and work on translating it and okay. deciphering the things that weren't known.
I want my audience to track with us here. So let's give the basic story of you know, there are three kinds of writing. One mm-hmm. is pictograph, when we think of Chinese characters, when we think of Egyptian hieroglyphics, it's just a picture that means one thing. It's like a word in a symbol. On the other end of the scale, we have alphabet. Alphabet is using 24 or 26 whatever letters, and they can say anything. They're very abstract. In the middle, we have syllabic script, linear B, something that every symbol is a syllable, not just a sound or a letter. And so you're dealing with all of this stuff, right? As you're looking at this, you're dealing with stuff that you're reading this stela, and you're saying that the stela is mostly Egyptian hieroglyphics, but then at the bottom there's kind of this picture, this cartoon that has several of these elements in it. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, and what's above the cartoon is a caption. These are hieroglyphs, most of them, except for these two outliers.
And what are the outliers?
There's one Canaanite syllabic, and there's one proto-consonantal letter.
Okay, so I just want to stop you. This is insane. You have three different kinds of writing. So you have all of this. You have this 4,000-year-old piece of stone with these inscriptions. Somebody discovers it 70 years ago. He translates a bunch of it. And then you, all these years later, say, wait a minute. Right here, we have what looks to be something that is a description of what the picture is. And the description uses, for some reason, maybe you're going to tell us, it uses not hieroglyphics, but a syllabic language, and there is a single letter from what appears to be an alphabet. I mean, this is it's confusing, but it's also kind of an amazing thing that all of this would be right there.
Yeah, and let me try to tie this together with a thread, Eric, to kind of show how this would happen. If this is Manasseh, think about it. He's one of the two sons of Joseph. When Jacob moved to Egypt and he was there, he lived 17 years, the last 17 years of his life. He was about to die. And what did he do? He said to Joseph, he said, Joseph, and I'm paraphrasing, Joseph, your two oldest boys that you brought here to visit me, they are mine. As for your other sons, they're yours, but these two are mine. So what was he doing? He was physically removing Manasseh, the oldest, and Ephraim, the second oldest, from their father and their mother and saying they have to live among their uncles. Why? Because Jacob, in that visit, he could see that these two boys were the bond that could connect these other sons of his to this new land of Egypt, where they didn't know the language, they didn't know the culture, they didn't know the religion, they didn't know the economy. But Ephraim and Manasseh were born there, and they did. So he hijacked these two children, brought them down to live with their uncles. And while they were there, they would have looked at their uncles and said, hey, uncles, we can write in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Our dad is the vizier. He's second in command in Egypt. How do you write in Hebrew? And the uncles would have said, well, we don't have anything to write with. We don't have a script. And the two boys would have looked at each other and said, hey, let's help out our uncles here. Let's codify the Hebrew language by making a script. Let's use 22 out of the 800 plus signs, turn them into consonantal letters so they make the sound of consonants.
Let's invent the world's first alphabet.
Bingo.
And that is what we're talking about. This is unbelievable. It's hard to take in. I'm glad we have more time. I'm talking to Douglas Petrovich. The new book is Origins of the Hebrews. We'll be right back. They see the truth before they can die. Tell me, Eric, why is Relief Factor so successful at lowering or eliminating pain? I'm often asked that question. The owners of Relief Factor tell me they believe our bodies were designed to heal. That's right, designed to heal, and I agree with them. So the doctors who formulated Relief Factor for them selected the four best ingredients, yes, 100% drug-free ingredients. Each helps your body deal with inflammation. Each of the four ingredients deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway. And that right there, approaching from four different angles, may be why so many people find such wonderful relief. So if you've got back pain, shoulder, neck, hip, knee, or foot pain from exercise or just getting older, you should order the 3-week quick start discounted to only $19.95 to see if it will work for you. It works for me. It has for about 70% of the 500,000 people who've tried it and have ordered more. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out about this offer. Feel the difference.
The fight for the unborn is raging in our country. An unprecedented leak from the Supreme Court indicates that Roe v. Wade is on the brink of being overturned. During this critical time, a new movie is about to be released, the award-winning film The Matter of Life. Cuts through the rhetoric and hatred and exposes the real issues surrounding the plight of the unborn. The Matter of Life will be in theaters nationwide for two nights only, May 16th and 17th. If you care about protecting the unborn, this is a movie you'll not want to miss. Go to fathomevents.com now to reserve your tickets for a theater near you for May 16th or May 17th and have your own life transformed as you watch The Matter of Life. That's Fathom, F-A-T-H-O-M, events.com, fathomevents.com. There is a battle, folks. It's taking place in America. Whether you're pro-choice or pro-life, you need to see this film. The Matter of Life is the film, May 16th and May 17th. Go to fathomevents.com right now, fathomevents.com.
Hey there, folks. I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Petrovich. The new book is Origins of the Hebrews, New Evidence of Israelites in Egypt from Joseph to the Exodus. Before that, the world's oldest alphabet. We're talking about crazy stuff, Dr. Douglas Petrovich. This is crazy stuff. We're talking about the discovery by you of some things that people have thought about and dreamed about and wondered about for a long time. And for some reason, God has allowed us in this hour, in this time, to know these things. And he's used you in this. And most people still don't know about this. Most people are hearing about it for the first time right now. And I feel honored that the Lord would allow me on this program to get this information out to the world. It's huge. So you're talking right now about how you puzzle together this the origins of the world's first alphabet, which becomes the Hebrew alphabet. And you're saying that the link to Hebrew is that these two grandsons of Jacob, two sons, the eldest sons of Joseph, they decide somehow, maybe you can tell us this again, but they say, hey, looks like we need a way to write our language. We don't have one. Let's invent it. And, you know, we'll do something even better than pictographs. We'll invent this thing so that with 22 symbols, we can write anything we want. We don't need thousands of symbols. We don't need 800 hieroglyphics or whatever the Chinese have, 40,000. We just need 22.
Yeah, and think about it, Eric. When they landed there at Avaris and they started to live among their uncles, they would have known right away what they were up against. These were sheep herders. These were goat herders. They weren't professional scribes, right? So you couldn't use one of the earlier scripts, the cuneiform script of Mesopotamia or the hieroglyphic script of Egyptian. And by the way, having studied Middle Egyptian hieroglyphics and later Egyptian hieroglyphics, I can tell you it's a very complex system, right? It's extremely complex. Hieroglyphs function in four different major ways, and you have to know at any one moment how it's being used in one of those four ways. So it's complex. But with their uncles, they knew they would have to figure out something that would be user-friendly for these sheepherders, right? So what they did is they chose hieroglyphs to be used as a drawing, making a picture. So when the uncle looks at the picture, he sees that it's a house. He knows it's a house, and he knows that the Hebrew word for house is bayit. So when he sees the house hieroglyph, he just pronounces the b sound that begins the word bayit, meaning house. So it's that. It's called an acrophonic principle. They devised the acrophonic principle to assign a consonantal value, b, k, r, s, to every picture that's drawn.
Okay.
And you just link together one after the
next.
So
a picture of a house gives us the Hebrew bet, beth. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're saying you're using what's called the construct form, which is really literally house of, but the absolute form of house is bayit. Bayit, house.
Okay, so that's where we get the letter B. I feel like I'm on the Electric Company or Sesame Street. B, house,
mm-hmm.
Bayit. I mean, this is the origins of everything we know. Anytime you write the letter B, it literally traces back to the moment you're describing when they need to come up with this. And so 4,000 years ago, they said, how can we do this? This thing. You know, these are pretty sharp kids to invent an alphabet, let's be honest. They were obviously kind of brainy, these children of Joseph.
Yeah, and endowed by God, right? But think about this. When we've often wondered, including biblical scholars, we've wondered when the Hebrew script came about. And we've wondered if the Bible says that Moses wrote down the law, and the law is recorded in Hebrew, Moses dies in 1406 BC, where's the script that he writes in? He's got to be writing in a known script. And so we've often wondered, how do you connect that script with what Moses wrote? And the Israelites were told at the time of the 10th plague to write on their doorposts, right? Well, how did they know how to write? And how could every common person be able to just write on a doorpost? They weren't scribes.
Isn't this the whole point, is that the reason what you've discovered is so controversial is because it makes it possible for us to understand how what the Bible says is true. And liberal scholars don't want to believe it's true. They want to discount it. Now they're going to have a hard time discounting it because you have shown how it was possible for Moses to write when people have been mocking that for a long time.
Right. And that's what's made me so many enemies, Eric. I mean, many of my colleagues in the field will not talk to me anymore. Some of my fellow graduate students that I went to school with at the University of Toronto won't communicate with me anymore. And late Exodus advocates who say the Exodus happened in the 13th century BC, they've thrown me under the bus.
Yeah.
They won't invite me to conferences to speak alongside of them. Nothing. I am thrown away.
Yeah, you're a troublemaker. And the reason is they're angry with God because you are really you've been chosen by God to deliver this this information. And it's yeah, it is controversial because it upsets a lot of apple carts, not just one.
Right. And think about the words of Jesus. He said, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." So I consider it to be a badge of honor that I would receive the criticism that I've received, whether that's ad hominem or whatever.
Well, on the flip side, of course, I imagine that there are many in the academic world who are very excited about this, or there are at least some who are inviting you and saying, please tell us more. This is big stuff.
Sure. And I've already spoken at, I don't know, probably 30 or 40 conferences since the 2012-2013 discoveries started coming. And so people are interested and excited. And yeah, there are biblical scholars who have embraced it. But they have to have a high view of the Bible, and they have to be open to the possibility that the Exodus happened in the century that biblical chronology requires that it happen, rather than just the century that the secular scholars are telling us it, if it happened at all, it had to happen in this century.
Yeah, you're putting them between a rock and a hard place because they're having to choose now, you know, because a lot of times people want to kind of have it both ways. And you're making it clear that, no, in fact, the Exodus happened in the 15th century B.C. It's what the text seems to say. And now we have more evidence and more evidence and more evidence. So it's fascinating because, you know, those of us who are not scholars, we love to know what's the story. We want to know when did this happen? When did this happen? And we forget how sometimes it really does take a long time for a consensus to emerge, even among those who do take the Bible seriously. So you have been talking about this stuff for almost a decade now, and there's a lot here. You were talking, for example, about the invention of the first alphabet. Just that is a huge deal. The idea that we know kind of how it happened. We know that the proto-consonantal script, the Hebrew, comes out of the Egyptian, which, if you don't believe there's any connection between Egypt and God's people who were there for four centuries, then that doesn't make sense. So the fact that you have found that alone is monumentally important.
It is. And so many things have come from this, too. It helps us to better, for example, better understand the inscriptions that are found in the land of Israel, ancient Canaan, that have always been kind of routinely characterized as proto-Canaanite, when really, and both of my books, I think, will if you're an objective learner, my books will destroy the position, the assumption that these are all Canaanite inscriptions when they're not. They are, in fact, Hebrew inscriptions, and they're a result of the process of that script that starts with these beautiful pictures becoming more and more abstract over time so that they could write faster and more efficient. But they explain things, then once you understand these inscriptions from Canaan are Hebrew, they explain things and they demonstrate that the Israelites are always where they're supposed to be when the Bible suggests that they are there. That's important.
So who are some of the people that have agreed with you and are trying to help you get this information out there?
Names like Bryant Wood, who's my archaeology mentor, Scott Stripling, Charles Ayling is another name. So, and another is Eugene Merrill, who's emeritus professor from Dallas Theological Seminary. So lots of important people who have made really important contributions in the field have already bought in.
Scott,
but others are kind of holding back.
Of course. They don't want to. It's very embarrassing. Scott Stripling was on this program very recently talking about the cursed tablets on Mount Ebal. This is all so fascinating. Folks, we're going to continue the conversation. Don't go away. Douglas Petrovich is my guest. In case you haven't been paying attention, the Biden administration has caused a financial crisis and they have no clue how to fix it. Oil prices have skyrocketed, and when oil prices go up, the cost of transportation and shipping spikes, leading the prices of goods to rise. And when we're already seeing record inflation, that's the last thing we need. Our economy is in trouble, and you need to take steps to protect yourself. If all your money is tied up in stocks, bonds, and traditional markets, you are vulnerable. Gold is one of the best ways to protect your retirement. No matter what happens, you own your gold. It is real. It is physical. It's always been valuable since the dawn of time. Legacy Precious Metals is the company I trust for investing in gold. They can help you roll your retirement account into a gold-backed IRA where you still own the physical gold. They can also ship gold and precious metals safely and securely to your house. Call Legacy at 866-528-1903 or visit them online at legacypminvestments.com.
Hey there, folks. Eric Metaxas here. I know you know how much I love Mike Lindell and MyPillow. Well, Mike Lindell and MyPillow right now are offering a BOGO extravaganza. BOGO, buy one, get one. BOGO extravaganza on multiple MyPillow products. Now's the time to join the millions of Americans who've changed the quality of their sleep with MyPillow. Right now, you get the buy one, get one free special. MyPillow bed sheets, Giza Elegance MyPillows, the six-piece towel sets, and the roll-and-go anywhere MyPillows. Just go to the Radio Listener Specials page at MyPillow.com. Use the promo code Eric. That's the Radio Listener Specials page at MyPillow.com. Use the code Eric or call 1-800-978-3057, 1-800-978-3057. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to buy one, get one free on select products. You'll also receive Mike's book absolutely free. You won't believe it. It's amazing. 800-978-3057 or MyPillow.com. Use the code Eric.
Hey there, folks. It's here from Taxes Show. I'm talking to Douglas Petrovich. Unbelievably fascinating stuff. Douglas Petrovich, I'm so glad somehow you came to my attention recently, because this is big stuff. And, you know, I don't live in the world of Egyptology or any of the stuff that we're talking about, even the world of archaeology. This is major stuff. It's controversial. It pulls a lot of pieces together. Let's just talk more about how you link what is, we call it extra biblical stuff that's outside of the Bible, that you read it and you say, oh my goodness, this is describing what happened in the Bible. I mean, I learned about this. I guess it was the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. I think of it as kind of the golden spike, when they realize this thing that's totally outside of the Bible that we discover in the sands of, I guess it was Egypt. I can't remember where they discovered the black obelisk, or Iraq. They discover this thing, and it points to stuff in the Bible. And so in the middle of the 19th century, people's heads exploded. They said, wow, we have proof outside of the Bible of what it says in the Bible, and then on and on and on. Who was it? I'm trying to think. It was a Flinders Petrie who read on the Merneptah steel. You know, this is the most ancient description found pointing to the God of the Bible. But you have pushed that date much farther back.
Right. And with that inscription that I told you about, Sinai 115, and the reference there to Israelites, I'm sorry, to Hebrews. Israel is on the Merneptah stele, but to Hebrews on this inscription from 1942 BC, that pushes back the earliest references, among extra-biblical references. It's the earliest one that attests to the Israelite nation. Previously, it had been the Merneptah stele, which I would date to 1219 BC. And then in 2010, there was a team of scholars led by Peter van der Veen, who published an article in an Egyptological journal that identified Israelites in a conquest by, and it doesn't tell what pharaoh is the king who was on the throne, but paleographically, their epigrapher, that's the person who handles and is an expert in inscriptions, he said that based on parallels from other Egyptian texts, that Amenhotep II's reign is the right time frame for this. And that goes along with everything that's, you know, that I've published since 2006, that says in the year of the Exodus, in that winter, there were 100,000 odd slaves acquired by Amenhotep II on his second Asiatic campaign. Why did he acquire 100,000 slaves? Well, if you look at the records, with his first Asiatic campaign and all of the Asiatic campaigns of his illustrious father, he was known as nowadays he's known as the Napoleon of Egypt. He had the most conquests of anyone, went the furthest with his imperial conquests. With all of those occasions when he invaded into Asia and conquered cities and brought back slaves, If you were to take the number that you add up from all those other campaigns, that number is 46 times less than the number of people taken during the Second Asiatic Campaign of Amenhotep II. Well, think about it. If the Exodus happened in that year and Egypt lost their slave base, which was the Israelites, could have been from thousands to hundreds of thousands in number, depending on the person's view, then all of a sudden there's a vacuum left in Egypt, and that vacuum has to be filled so that they could keep the war machine going, keep the internal operations in the country going. So what did they do? They went on a slave run. And among those 100,000 captives, Eric, in that year 7 conquest of Amenhotep II in Asia, he just went into the southern Levant, were 3,600 Apiru. Apiru is the Egyptian name for Habiru. Habiru is the Akkadian equivalent of the Hebrew Hebrews. So these were 3,600 Habirus or Hebrews who were captured by the Exodus Pharaoh the very same year of the Exodus, after the Exodus happened, probably, and this is in a quiet period in biblical history, right? There's a period of months after Sinai for like 14 months that nothing is recorded by Moses. And in that quiet period, that's when this campaign takes place. So probably 3,600 people among the Israelites left the band with Moses, and they went off into Canaan, and they said, we're not waiting 40 years or dying in the desert. We're going in the land now.
We want to go back to Egypt, man. We're tired of eating manna. Let's go back to Egypt.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. This is so, I mean, honestly, this is so fascinating. And I know that this is, you know, even people that agree on most of this stuff, it's still controversial because, I mean, we had Dr. Stephen Collins on here recently. He believes that the Pharaoh of the Exodus is Thutmose IV, I think, if I remember correctly. So he has different ideas and things. And so, but there's something to me so wonderful about trying to puzzle this out, looking at the information and trying to figure it out and getting more and more information day by day. We're going to go back. We're going to go to a break, but we're going to come back for a final segment with Dr. Douglas Petrovich. The new book is Origins of the Hebrews, New Evidence of Israelites in Egypt from Joseph to the Exodus. Tell me, Eric, why is Relief Factor so successful at lowering or eliminating pain? I'm often asked that question. The owners of Relief Factor tell me they believe our bodies were designed to heal. That's right, designed to heal, and I agree with them. So the doctors who formulated Relief Factor for them selected the four best ingredients, yes, 100% drug-free ingredients. Each helps your body deal with inflammation. Each of the four ingredients deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway. And that right there, approaching from four different angles, may be why so many people find such wonderful relief. So if you've got back pain, shoulder, neck, hip, knee, or foot pain from exercise or just getting older, you should order the 3-week quick start discounted to only $19.95 to see if it will work for you. It works for me. It has for about 70% of the 500,000 people who've tried it and have ordered more. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out about this offer. Feel the difference.
In case you haven't been paying attention, the Biden administration has caused a financial crisis and they have no clue how to fix it. Oil prices have skyrocketed, and when oil prices go up, the cost of transportation and shipping spikes, leading the prices of goods to rise. And when we're already seeing record inflation, that's the last thing we need. Our economy is in trouble, and you need to take steps to protect yourself. If all your money is tied up in stocks, bonds, and traditional markets, you are vulnerable. Gold is one of the best ways to protect your retirement. No matter what happens, you own your gold. It is real. It is physical. It's always been valuable since the dawn of time. Legacy Precious Metals is the company I trust for investing in gold. They can help you roll your retirement account into a gold-backed IRA where you still own the physical gold. They can also ship gold and precious metals safely and securely to your house. Call Legacy at 866-528-1903 or visit them online at legacypminvestments.com.
Folks, welcome back. Talking to Dr. Douglas Petrovich. Okay, I want to remind, I didn't want to forget, rather, to ask you, it's pronounced Merneptah-Stele. How do you say it?
Yeah, I would pronounce it. There's several ways in English. I would pronounce it Merneptah. Merneptah-Stele.
Merneptah-Stele. I've been saying the Merneptah-Stele. But you know what? I get stuff wrong all the time. But listen, just to impress my audience, I want them to know that my final question to you regards something called the Lachish Milk Bowl Ostrakhan. Who doesn't want to know about the Lachish Milk Bowl Ostrakhan? So tell us about that.
Yeah, and you're going to want to find this out. So in 2018, there was an archaeological team that did work at a site in southwestern Canaan, Israel, called Lachish. It was the second largest Canaanite city in all of Israel, second to Hazor in the north. And once Hazor was knocked off, it became the greatest, the most powerful, the most densely populated site. Well, they had interactions with people in Egypt for quite some time. And that site was conquered at the end of what's called the Late Bronze Age 1B period, which is roughly 1400 BC. So right before 1400 BC, the site was conquered by an unknown people, and there's an inscription that was found there, Eric. I refer to it as the Lachish Milk Bowl Ostrakhan. I published an article about this in spring of 2022. It's based on the definitive publication by the archaeologists in May or June, I think, of 2021. And this ostrakhan was found just inside the city wall on top of a burn layer that reflects the destruction of this city that I connect to Joshua.
What is an ostrakhan? For people me who aren't sure what an ostrakhan is.
Sure. You take an ancient pot or an ancient bowl or an ancient jug and you break it, right? It falls to the ground, breaks into pieces. One of those pieces, some guy or some woman picks it up and says, I'm going to write something on this, a grocery list. So they write down their groceries that they want on that potsherd.
Right.
And once they've written on it, now it becomes an ostrakhan.
Okay, so the Lachish Milk Bowl Ostrakhan, you wrote about this very recently. You've been talking about this like within the last couple of months.
Yes, and it's already the newest controversial thing that I've put out. But it's composed in this exact same script that derived from Egypt from the 19th century BC that over time becomes, again, less pictographic and more abstract. And it represents the next phase in how the script looks, how it's written at the end of the 14th or 15th century BC, just before 1400 BC. And it has a really important message on there. It reads... servant in charge of honey, servant in charge of honey. The word honey on there is only found in Hebrew. There's no other Semitic language that is found in. So to look at this inscription and say, oh, it's Canaanite. Well, wrong. There's no Canaanite use of this term for honey in their language, but it is in Hebrew. So servant in charge of honey. This was like a business card. And so the way I would picture it is Joshua and his forces, they went in to fight against the city of Lachish. And you can read about this in Joshua 10. It's in the text. It took them 2 days to overcome the city, whereas the next city on the list, Eglon, it took only 1 day. It's because Lachish is so big. So they conquered the city. And one of the people that would have been part of the raiding band would have been the guy who was in charge of the honey supply. So once the Israelites got into the land of Canaan, Joshua and his forces, when they attacked the city after Jericho, they would have looted the city, right? They would have killed all the people and looted the goods and used them for the military band. And so he put different people in charge of different roles, apparently. And so this one guy was put in charge of the honey. So whenever they went to another city and they captured the city, somebody would have collected, this guy, he would have collected the honey reserve and would have carried it along with him so that whenever somebody on the team in the army needed some honey that day, they would go to him and they would say, hey, servant in charge of honey, give us some honey. And we'll add it, and we'll consume it. So when they attacked the city, they went inside and they killed all the people. They probably had to, at the breach points, the breach in the wall, they had to attack, and probably there was some fire that was involved. And sure enough, there's a breach in the wall that the archaeologists didn't talk about, but it's in their photos. There's a breach in the wall right there. And then on top of a burn layer, and the burn layer dates to the end of the 15th century BC when the Bible suggests that Joshua attacked the cities of Canaan, there's this inscription. And probably after they killed all the people on the way out, the servant in charge of honey drops his business card, intentionally or unintentionally, drops it right before he exits through that same breach outside the city, and it's left for posterity. And the city, of course, is
pottery posterity.
Yeah.
Right. I've always wanted to say those two words together, pottery posterity. Why would he have done that? Why would he drop his business card, so to speak? I don't get that.
Yeah. And it's possible that it was unintentional. It slipped out of his, you know, the equivalent of a pocket. It could have been unintentional.
His ceramic briefcase. Gosh, this is it's amazing. So you're telling me that we have extremely recent evidence, again, for now we're talking about the 15th century BC, of the Bible being true. And this is the most recent controversy, and you've been circulating, upsetting people on this issue.
Yes, because it's providing more evidence that the Exodus happened in 1446 BC and the conquest of Canaan happened from 1406 to 1400 BC, just like biblical chronology requires.
It's amazing stuff. Is there a website where people can find you?
Yes. You can go to my academia.edu webpage. I have a Twitter page. You could go there, but I have an academia.edu webpage, and there I have uploaded all of my published articles and some unpublished works as a professor. So you can go there, download those for free, and there are some really important tools.
We're out of time, but I'm just thrilled to get to know you a little bit, Douglas Petrovich, and to introduce you to my audience, who can find you at academia.edu and other places, Twitter. Congratulations. God bless you. And we'll have you back to continue the conversation. Thanks again.
You're welcome, Eric.
Hey there, folks. We've had the most amazing day today listening to Doug Petrovich. Folks, I hope you're impressed. I got to tell you, it's something amazing that when you find someone who's discovered something, this is like my Is Atheism Dead book. I discovered all this stuff. I thought, why don't people know about this? That's how I feel about Douglas Petrovich. You think like, this is amazing. I want to get this information out to people. It's astonishing, really. Yeah. Okay, we've got a few announcements. I want to say that there are still tickets available for Socrates in the City. If you go to socratesinthecity.com, if you know somebody in New York or who can get to New York, maybe you want to bless them with kind of an amazing evening. I'm going to talk to a man who claims to have walked on the moon. I don't believe it, but we're going to see what his story is. Charlie Duke, Apollo 16 astronaut. It's just crazy. Yeah. I also want to remind everybody that maybe by the time we're having this conversation, the Supreme Court will have released the information on whether Roe v. Wade was overturned. So I don't know. If so, you can bet we're going to be talking about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I also want to say, I'm supposed to say that we are, I'm still in Colorado. I've been stranded here, but I'm on my way home. And really, when I spoke at the Road Church, Pastor Steve Holt in Colorado Springs, everybody came up to me in the book signing line, said, I saw you last night in 2000 Mules. And I thought, it's in theaters. It is in theaters. Folks, if you want to see it in theaters, which I hope you do, you can go to 2000mules.com and find out. But it's in theaters all across the country. And everybody needs to see it. Let me be blunt. Everyone needs to see it. Please, please. This is, as an American, you need to understand what happened. And you're responsible for spreading the information, for sharing the information. This is absolutely unbelievable what happened in our nation. And everybody, I've lost friends. I've lost all kinds of stuff because people are like, I can't believe he's a, what do they say? He's an election denier or denier, whatever it is. And I thought, look, if I'm wrong, I'd be thrilled. But the problem is I know that I'm not, the more that I look at. So if you see 2,000 mules, I ought to say, I'm legally obliged to say that Salem, we're on the Salem network, on the Salem radio network, salemnow.com is where you can see the film also, salemnow.com. And because Salem is one of the producers of the film, I'm obliged to say that. So, you know, I have a vested interest. I even get, this is no joke, because I'm in the film wearing my green pants and cracking a couple of jokes, I get like some percentage. Trust me when I tell you it's teeny, teeny weeny, but legally I'm supposed to mention that. So, hey, if I get a big check, we can have a party. But the fact is that I am honored to be in the film, but I don't care about the fact that I'm in the film. What I care about is that Dinesh D'Souza and Catherine Engelbrecht, they put together something that is potentially historic, which will wake up Americans to what happened so that it'll never happen again. But you're going to have to get involved. You're going to have to see it. You're going to have to tell your friends. It's in theaters, folks. Buy tickets for somebody who wouldn't see it themselves. You need to do your part to wake people up.
And before we go, CSI, Christian Solidarity International, for the folks over there in Ukraine, you've got to contribute this week. This is the last week, folks, to donate something to our campaign. Go to MetaxasTalk.com. Right there at the top is the banner. Click on it. Give something. We're giving away grand prizes for any donation at all. We pull your three names out of a hat, any amount. And you can win all kinds of books and T-shirts and stickers and hats.
That's right. You go to MetaxasTalk.com. But to get my newsletter, because a lot of people are not getting my newsletter, for my newsletter, you go to Metaxas. You go to EricMetaxas.com. EricMetaxas.com. We're out of time. I hope I get home today. Thank you.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.